Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to the Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I am joined today by Nick Gillespie. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Andrew.
Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, Catherine.
Howdy.
And Brian Doherty. Hello.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to cover a lot of ground today, from President Trump potentially pardoning himself to Google's now apparently astral ambitions. But before we do that, I'd like to get started with some swipes against libertarianism. A new book by Nancy MacLean called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, imbues libertarianism as evil coke shills and apparently posits that the goal of libertarianism is literally to reinforce or reinstate serfdom, among other things. So, Brian, how accurately has Professor MacLean been able to judge our conspiracy to return the world to oligarchy?
I'm going to say one nice thing for Miss MacLean, Professor MacLean. Sorry, there's not a lot nice to say about her book, which is it's startlingly wrong. And every day you find out some new thing she got wrong. And most of us reading it are assuming, well, I don't really know that much about that, but surely she got that close to right. And as more experts are honing on different parts, you're finding out that nearly everything about it is wrong. But the nice thing to say for her, and this is the only thing that matters to her audience, which I think libertarians don't realize, is that she indeed has pinpointed that the thought of James Buchanan and the political efforts funded or connected in some way to the Koch family would possibly limit government's power to tax and redistribute. And that's all she actually cares about. And if you're following, if you're insane enough to be following all the back and forth between me and the various other academic critics of the book and her defenders and even her own very lame and weak defense, they keep on saying that everything we say she got wrong, well, that's not the book's real point. That's not the core point. Well, that may not be exactly right, but that doesn't really damage the book's core point. And they're not very quick to state exactly what the core point is, but I did them the favor of stating it. And what it is there are intellectuals and activists and financiers who might want to try to restrict government's power to tax and redistribute. And these people are villains, and no standards of scholarly probity or interpretational charity or even interpretational intelligence matter at all. Because if you're throwing mud at these people, it is a mud ball well thrown, you know, no matter what the actual facts are.
Well, you know, I think to follow up on that, and I've read the book as well, and Brian's review at Reason.com is really great and pinpoints a lot of the specifics, although you can't pinpoint all of them, because it is really true that she gets almost virtually everything wrong, or as her Duke colleague, Michael Munger, a political scientist and economist, put in a great review at the Independent Institute's website. There's the way in which, and I guess you mentioned this, Brian, she interprets everything in the most, kind of cockeyed way and mendacious way, so that any stray thought becomes central to a figure if it furthers her case, that specifically that libertarianism is somehow an outgrowth of John C. Calhoun, political thought, the great slavery apologist who didn't simply kind of defend slavery as a necessary evil or something that was inherited, but rather as a positive good. And she traces this really awful and just completely fictitious straight line between that and James Buchanan, the widely considered the creator of public choice economics, or one of them, who talked about the public sector and actors in the public sector having similar motives as actors in the private sector. He once described his school of thought as politics without romance, and it was merely that you would look at the consequences of government policy as opposed to the intentions or the explicit statements surrounding it, that you would actually assume that public sector actors, like private sector actors, are always trying to increase their resources, increase their market share, and that they often misadvertise the goals or intentions or certainly the effects of their policy. To me, that idea of trying to, in many ways, this book is a giant smear tactic. And early on in the book, she talks about how the Koch brothers, as well as James Buchanan, as well as all libertarians, are a fifth column in American society. And she goes on at length to say, this is a term that was created during the Spanish Civil War. and you know, to describe Franco followers who are lying in wait and kind of doing propaganda work and burrowing from the inside out to create fascism. And she says, you know, this is a loaded term, and I don't want to say that these people are literally a fifth column or a fascist, but in fact, this is the term that we must use. And that kind of thing goes on all the time in the book, where she'll introduce a thinker or a thought, and then that is just scurrilous or awful. And then she'll say, this isn't exactly right, but we should use those terms or that kind of mental map anyway. And it's quite a thing to behold. And the one thing that I would say that libertarians might find interesting about it is that she does posit that libertarianism has essentially become the motive force in every aspect of American life and certainly political life, which I know as somebody who looks upon the hundreds of thousands of people who are arrested each year for simple possession of marijuana, for people who want to see more open borders, for people who want to see actual free trade and an end to occupational licensing, I find it kind of, I wish that libertarians were more influential than we have.
Has anybody done yet a Nancy McLean style review of Nancy McLean's book? Because it seems like when you were just describing her mode of writing, where she says, here's this horrific accusation, and then I'm going to back off it a little bit. It's precisely the sort of selective quotation that she's been accused of, particularly with regard to Tyler Cowen's work and some others. You could really write a bang up variant of the Nancy McLean thesis, probably with the strategic use of ellipses. Maybe we should try that.
I've seen people kind of playing with that in like a paragraph or two in sort of the social networking places where McLean's dedicated claque of foes, including me, gather. One depressing thing I do want to point out that Nick said reminded me is that, of course, we know that the libertarian message and libertarian policies have an awful lot to offer the kind of progressive left audience who McLean is clearly aiming at. And I think one of the things McLean is trying to do in her book is to sort of dissuade any of them from daring to, take our blandishment seriously. Like all of those things where progressives and libertarians might come into agreement, she literally doesn't even allude to any of them in her book. The one thing she close focuses on is this whole taxing and redistribution issue. And in her mind, and unfortunately to the minds of a lot of her readers, that is the only issue that matters. And they don't care what else they could ally with us on. They're just peeved over the taxing part.
Well, and I think it's worth focusing on that, too, because she, on a certain level, like what she argues that James Buchanan in particular and libertarians more broadly, the Kochs, somewhere in between those two things, want to limit democracy in the ways that you're talking about, and Brian, and of course, that goes back at least to Magna Carta, if not even more. And actually, even if you look at the writings of people like Thomas Jefferson and the founders of America, as well as the revolutionaries in 17th century England, they even noted in Rome, in imperial Rome, when it was at its maximal power, Roman citizens, had certain rights that the government could not abrogate. And the idea that you would be in favor of unlimited democracy, that actually puts you in the same category as people like Robert Bork, who the left rightly denounced at a certain point, or certainly after his Supreme Court nomination writings, where he essentially argued constantly that as long as a majority of representatives who were duly elected according to the laws of the land in a fake election, a majority, a simple majority, could force people to live the way that they want. And I don't even think most progressives would go that far when you start putting it in those terms. That is the government really unlimited so that a majority of people can say this or that? And, this is something Damon Root, our colleague at Reason, has written a lot about, that the Constitution is not a value-free document. It's not simply a kind of mathematical formula for how to govern. It encodes specific rights that are reserved to individuals that no majority, no government can take away. And that's actually one of the things that, Americans, regardless of ideological persuasion, I think actually stand behind, because we recognize that we don't want an unlimited government any more than we want a government which cannot enforce most basic laws, including things like contract rights.
Yeah, I want to add on to that. One of the problems with this book, and I don't want to be too rude, but she really shows a remarkably low level of analytical intelligence to the point where certain things in it are so on their face absurd that the critic almost feels embarrassed pointing it out. But as I am obligated to point out in my review, of course, most progressives don't believe that democracy should never be held in chains, to use her scary phrase. And of course, she doesn't believe it either. And you know that this is true because the entire narrative, which her book starts with and which takes up a third of her book, is a celebration, a rightful celebration of the Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Board of Education, and a sort of sideways and not very convincing attempt to prove that James Buchanan was out to defeat it. And to spell it out for those of you, and it's embarrassing to have to do so, Brown itself was a case of a constitution that limited government's powers, overturning what would have been a majority decision to keep segregated schools in the name of individual rights. And that's exactly Buchanan's intellectual project. So it's not that Nancy McLean does not want to keep democracy in chains. She just wants to yank those chains in different directions than she thinks a libertarian would.
Catherine, I'm sort of surprised continually about the position of libertarians in modern American society. I would think or thought coming into the libertarian fold that being socially liberal, socially tolerant, and fiscally conservative, libertarians would be sort of bridge builders between the left and the right and would generally get along with both camps. But I find a lot of the time that libertarians become sort of demonized by both the right and the left. Do you find that to be the case, and why?
I think both of those things are true. The McLean case, though, is absolutely an example of someone using the places where she differs with libertarians to signal her own virtue. She's saying, listen, I have used my super powerful sniffer to sniff out a vague hint of racism somewhere near these guys, and I am therefore going to devote hundreds of pages to showing how they are, in fact, part of a racist evil conspiracy. And by the way, I am different than these people. And yeah, you know, there is absolutely a book that a dedicated liberal and progressive could write about the useful insights of public choice theory and James Buchanan's work for the left, or, you know, the things that progressives and James Buchanan have in common. And in fact, she highlights that there was, you know, Buchanan's relationship with the libertarian movement, with the Kochs, with libertarians generally was not an unmixed one. It's sort of similar to the story with Ayn Rand in some ways. And the choice instead to tell the story of this evil conspiracy that's out to ruin America while totally eliding, as people constantly do with, for instance, the Kochs, support for criminal justice reform, support for gay marriage. There are places you could choose to find commonalities, and the fact that the left consistently chooses not to, and that the right, not consistently, but more often, chooses to look for those common ground, to look for the places where we agree, is one reason that many libertarians, particularly older libertarians, identify with the right wing. And I think that's, you know, that's something we've talked about on this podcast before. But you know, when you are reviled by both sides, but consistently reviled in the harshest terms by the left, it's tricky to keep putting a bright face on it. And I think that's what libertarians should still do. I think we should still always be saying to everyone, let's talk about what we have in common. Let's talk about how you can, you know, how we can bridge some places where we disagree by talking about what we agree about. That work to me nearly always seems harder with the left, particularly with people on the left of the McLean stripe, which is to say anyone who is at all even slightly conspiracy minded.
You know, if I can add, too, there's an interesting kind of through line to some of the arguments that she's talking about. As Brian pointed out, the book really starts with Brown versus Board of Education, or actually a Southern response, the segregationist response to it, particularly in Virginia. Is worth recounting or recalling. There were several counties in Virginia that actually said, rather in the wake of Brown versus Board decision, where any schools receiving federal funds would have to integrate, a number of counties in Virginia chose to suspend any form of public schooling or any type of high school at the very least. And they started talking about, well, why don't we just give money directly to parents, and that way we would avoid any kind of restriction on the way that they're used. And it's very similar to school choice. And actually, in his original essay kind of outlining the idea of a school voucher, writer, Milton Friedman. And I believe she actually doesn't pick up on this, but he actually explicitly says, look, some of the people who were practicing what was called massive resistance against integration, you know, actually came up with the idea of a voucher. And he said, you know, this is, you know, those people are awful, but this is actually a pretty good idea for a variety of reasons. And so you have the specter of libertarians in the 50s coming up with school vouchers as a way to empower individuals in a way that actually, you know, did fall in line with some segregationist thinking. And now libertarians are the ones who have been pushing school choice in a robust way, including vouchers. And it's now almost exclusively a province, you know, the people who most want school choice when you look at polling and things like that are African Americans who have continued to be ill-served by public education in the United States, despite all sorts of attempts to reform it or focus more attention on underprivileged people, people with lower income, people with lower whose parents have lower educational outcomes and achievements. You know, so in a way, the libertarians come out very strong on the issue of school choice, even though it is, and this is, you know, one of the things that I think progressives hate and conservatives hate, is that libertarians do end up saying that some people are awful. Their belief systems are awful. Their value systems are awful. They have nothing to do with a kind of cosmopolitan, worldly, inclusive view, a pluralistic view. And yet we should allow them to, you know, live their lives they want to, as long as they're not forcing other people to. And, you know, and on school choice, I think libertarians took an idea and have created something meaningful of it, which is, you know, which is desired by more and more people. There isn't a school choice program in the country that doesn't have a massive waiting list. And the reason for that is that all sorts of people want more choice in their educational options. And, you know, again, I mean, I think that ultimately speaks very well to libertarians, and it doesn't speak well to progressives, especially, who are insisting after, you know, 50 or 60 years or more of more and more spending per pupil, smaller and smaller class size, all of these things, they are invested, you know, literally and figuratively in just maintaining the status quo that continues to really poorly serve the people who are getting the shittiest educations possible.
Nick, can we delve a little bit more into the sort of dare I say, accommodation of bigotry, which exists within libertarianism? I don't think anybody here has any negative, you know, negative motivations that they have. But McLean documents in her book that I think the Freeman and the Volcker Fund had been opponents of Brown versus Board of Education. And I think today, while I hope to one day officiate a gay wedding, I would not require a cake maker to make a cake for gays. And while that's coming from my perspective, from individual rights, it also might align with a bigot. So are racists and homophobes, are they part of the libertarian movement? Is it something that's just congruent? What's the interaction between the two?
Well, I think that, you know, this kind of speaks to the point Catherine was raising about kind of the sociology of libertarian alliances. And when you talk to a lot of people, you know, how did they get into libertarianism? You know, there's Ayn Rand, there's Robert Heinlein, there's people like Milton Friedman, and then there's Barry Goldwater and his campaign in 1964, the presidential campaign, where he was much more conservative than he was later in his career, which is we tend to remember Barry Goldwater talking in the 1980s about gays, you know, that gays should be fully enfranchised into the American dream. They should be able to get married. Who cares about, you know, people's personal lives? He was critical of American foreign policy in places like Nicaragua and the mining of various harbors in Central America. He was much more libertarian at the end of his life than he was in the mid-60s and when he ran in 1964, although he did harken back to a kind of 19th century, you know, limited government. But he did also, he campaigned and won the votes of a lot of segregationists. And I think that's where the original confusion starts. And Catherine, you'll recall the event we had with Ovik Roy, the healthcare analyst who runs a free market kind of pro economic opportunity for minorities think tank in Texas. Now, he mentioned, you know, that that libertarians' kind of uncritical embrace of Barry Goldwater or use of him is problematic because Barry Goldwater does figure sometimes, in some ways rightly, in most ways wrongly, as a kind of marker for the willingness of the Republican Party or of a major party to court the vote of bigots well past the Civil Rights era and his unwillingness to sign the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So I think that that's part of, you know, that's kind of the sociology of this. Andrew, to your larger point, it is it's difficult, you know, to say, but I think it's worth saying, which is that, you know, libertarians, I know no libertarians who are racist or segregationist or are homophobic. If anything, Reason Magazine and the Libertarian, Reason Magazine started in 1968, the Libertarian Party started in 1971. By the early 70s, when, you know, orthodox liberal publications like the New Republic, National Review on the conservative side, they were still, you know, talking about gays as having a mental illness and needing to be fixed and things like that. We were promoting specifically gay marriage and equal rights for every individual, regardless of, you know, of their sexual orientation or their race or class or anything like that. So there's a split there. And I do think that libertarianism, one of the places where it needs to grow is to making clear to non-traditional audiences for libertarian ideas and policies that it's not just inclusive. We actually have policies and programs that would help alleviate a lot of the problems of disadvantaged groups.
I also want to say that, I mean, if you have a political movement where you say explicitly, as we do, as we should, you're allowed to be an asshole as long as you don't hurt anyone else. That's going to be the party of assholes. Like, that is an unfortunate thing about the deeply true and important philosophical tenet, you're allowed to be an asshole. And of course the assholes are going to want to come hang out with us. It doesn't mean that there is something inherent in the philosophy that is racist or homophobic. It means racists and homophobes will recognize that if the choice is go to jail under somebody else's set up and, well, maybe these guys will let me have a little community somewhere where I can be a homophobe. Yeah, we will. We will let you do that. And, you know, if that's frankly probably one of the biggest structural problems with widespread adoption of libertarianism. Now, I think, of course, as Nick said, we also have solutions for so many other people that, you know, we are not just the party that would be the best for assholes. We are also the party that would be best for the virtuous.
Well put. The assholes still want to come. It is the party for the virtuous and the assholes because it's not into mind control. And this weekend, libertarians descended en masse to Las Vegas for Freedom Fest, which is the Lollapalooza of people who own Milton Friedman paraphernalia. I got to open for William Shatner and he said, I'm funny. I got my palm read. I met a bunch of people. I had a great time. Nick, what was your takeaway from Freedom Fest? Did you have anything that surprised you?
I like to think of Freedom Fest as Altamont every year in July, and rather than Lollapalooza. But it was a lot of fun. It was interesting, and I think what you actually see at Freedom Fest, which was celebrating its 10th anniversary, and it is the largest annual gathering of libertarians and free market kind of types, activists, enthusiasts, things like that, policymakers. There was a lot of really good and interesting talk from people like Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, Justin Amash, Thomas Massey, who are Republicans but are libertarian leaning, and increasingly in at least one conversation, Amash in particular said, get rid of the leaning in my descriptor. Don't call me a libertarian leaning Republican, just call me a libertarian Republican. So we're partway there. If we can only get rid of the Republican, I think we'll really be making progress. But these guys talk in very principled ways about limiting the size, scope, and spending of government, which is the one path that has not been tried yet. Freedom Fest has its roots, and Brian actually knows this better than I do, but it has its roots in a hard money conference that had been run a few years before. And as a result of that, it still is representing an alliance between kind of conservative, like social conservatives who are into free markets, and libertarians who tend to be much more socially inclusive as well as into free markets. And there is always tension there. And one of the things that strikes me kind of dispositionally about the people who tend to be more conservative versus the ones who tend to be more libertarian is that conservatives are apocalyptics. They're always talking about how the end is nigh, and it could be, in a way they're like environmentalists, and it could be because of moral decay, which interestingly was one of Barry Goldwater's themes in his 1964 campaign, but about moral decay in America. But they are worried by gatekeeper institutions breaking down and people being left to make more decisions on their own. They are troubled by a lot of social issues, including things like gay marriage and drug legalization or even free expression in the cultural arena. And so that's always one of the things I find interesting about Freedom Fest is the tension between conservative free marketers who tend to be much more pessimistic about the present and the future and libertarians who tend to be more optimistic.
Yeah, I think we tend to have a lot of techno-optimists. We saw a tremendous amount of that on Saturday, which was Reason Day at Freedom Fest, which was 95% science fiction nerding out and maybe 5% politics. But you could really see the overlap of sci-fi futurism and libertarianism. And one of the embodiments of moral decay that you mentioned that the conservatives are afraid of, Catherine Megger Ward, was leading some of these panels. Catherine, what was your experience like? And did you got to meet a science fiction author, David Brin, and rub elbows with everybody else? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I always am happy to talk about my plans to move to Mars with anyone who wants to chat about it with me. And certainly that was a place where there turned out to be enough overlap with the Freedom Fest crowd. I think one thing that David Brin said, which I thought was interesting, and he is the author of The Postman, which was turned into a horrible movie with Kevin Costner. But is one of a sort of science fiction classic.
And probably the only book that really tries to heroicize postal workers, I think.
Right. But he did say, like, listen, the point of heroicizing the postal worker is because this is a sort of in a world where there are no more institutions, individuals can still do the work of institutions, which is a sort of very libertarian friendly insight. One thing that he talked about was this sort of apocalyptic versus optimistic feeling in the air, and in particular how that plays out right now in science fiction. The idea that particularly young adult science fiction has tilted much more heavily toward dystopian themes recently, and whether that is a sign that we are actually living in a dystopia or just that we are appropriately on guard against winding up in one, or something else entirely is going on. And I think that was maybe more broadly the theme of the conference as well. The other panels that I did were about the media, and woo doggies, do older libertarian-leaning conservatives hate, quote-unquote, the media. They really see that as an agent of evil, as an agent of decay. It's always awkward to be a journalist on that panel, like, hi, I'm the media. But then they're like, oh, no, not you. We don't mean you.
In that kind of formulation, do people ever address how we have had, 40 or 50 years and the media as enemy, of course, is as old as the Republic itself. But among conservatives and libertarians to a certain degree about how the mainstream media is constantly, it's feeding a line and it's lying to people and it's creating fake news, all of that kind of stuff. How is it that as the media gets worse and worse, Republicans in particular, who are always the enemy of the media in this telling, somehow gain, they win more and more elections, they take over more and more state houses, they run Congress. Do they ever address that seeming contradiction?
I think it certainly comes up obliquely, but I think more central is this question of, well, who wields power now in terms of setting the narrative? And I think there is still this fear that the New York Times and ABC News get to set the narrative for the nation. And I frankly just don't think that's true. So if you believe that's true, then what you're seeing in those two outlets, you rightly should be alarmed if you are a person who likes free markets or Republicans. But I don't think that that's actually anymore. I think it once was, but I don't think it's anymore really the locus of power and of agenda setting. And actually, there was a headline that I saw a few days back that was like, major news outlets think that Google has too much power to set news agenda. And it was like, yeah, well, I'm sure you are nostalgic for the days that you had too much power to set the news agenda, but it doesn't mean it's bad that Google's sharing that power with you now.
One of the other side themes of the conference or stuff that came out there, Last year, before the election, there was a Trump or no Trump, you know, Trump or never Trump panel, a debate which I moderated. And this time I was a participant in. And one of the things that is stunning to me are the pro-Trump, I don't know, I mean, there are some pro-Trump libertarians, and there are certainly pro-Trump conservatives. And one of the kind of impoverished position of that kind of argument is that a lot of the people on the panel who were debating a pro-Trump side, that Trump is good for limited government and free markets, the main point even 100 days into his presidency was that he's better than Hillary. And then they would talk about the long list of particulars that Hillary Clinton would have inflicted on the country or is guilty of, but it will not be brought to justice. And isn't that a shame? And it seems at some point, Trump has to own the presidency and his supporters have to own his policies, which I suspect that a lot of people don't want to do that because they are in most ways, not in all ways, but in many, many ways are, you know, fundamentally opposed to anything resembling libertarianism.
Hey, Brian, can I ask you a question about libertarian history?
Sure.
Did libertarians always hate the media? I mean, obviously, at some point, someone was like, hey, we should found Reason Magazine. We can do better than this garbage, perhaps. But, you're our resident historian.
Yeah, as a dominant theme, certainly not. I think Fox, ironically, Fox's very existence as something that that became the media, you know, to the right wing, seems to be the largest nexus of in comparing themselves to everyone else. Like, we're the real truth for you guys and, you know, screw the rest of the mainstream media. I certainly don't recall, and I certainly didn't mention it at all in my, you know, book, which was written in the first half of the aughts, that there was some dominant theme of libertarians being angry at the media. Though certainly if you press them, they would recognize that, oh yeah, the media doesn't really represent our views too much, but it wasn't like they got really angry and hostile about it.
Well, they were too busy being angry and hostile about the inability to own gold, right? Until
no, exactly.
Until, yeah.
Well, Nick, a moment ago, you brought up the Never Trump and Ever Trump panels and the camps that exist. And you've talked in the past, I think very accurately, that there tends to be a either complete demonization or alternately a idolization of Trump in that he can either do no right or he can do no wrong. And I think generally at Reason, we tend to be more on a case-by-case basis. But he is gearing up for yet another case of either good or ill with Russia. This week, he is reportedly supporting sanctions that are going to come out of the House. If you're listening to White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, he seems to be supportive of sanctioning Russia. Whereas if you listen to incoming Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci, Trump is unconvinced of Russian meddling in the 2016 election, which is what these sanctions are for, and sees that as a way to delegitimize his victory. At the same time, he's also reportedly exploring whether or not he can pardon himself for potential criminal wrongdoing in the 2016 election or members of his family.
So yeah, he's a Renaissance man. You know, it's I guess the real question is, can he pardon Putin for anything that he might be involved in the American elections? But this drives home kind of the point that and again, I you know, this may be unintentional or not, but it's kind of like, you know, if Trump is supposed to be Putin's lapdog, he's kind of a bad president for Russia in a lot of ways, not simply because it looks like he is going to extend sanctions or increase sanctions, but also that he is, this to me, and I know we talked about it last week, but the underreported story of his European trip was the deal to export liquefied natural gas to Central and Eastern Europe, which really hits Russia where it counts because it provides an alternative energy source for a part of the world which largely relies on Russia and Russian exports for, for its fuel and for all sorts of things. So Trump, in a lot of ways, he's no bargain for Russia. He may not be interested in getting involved in internal politics or near internal politics of the old Soviet Union. But he is, you know, he's revivified NATO in a kind of backhanded way, where Europeans seem much more interested in funding a forward defense of their interests on the European continent. He's not letting Russia go gently into that good night and take over, you know, London and Iceland and Reykjavik or anything like that. So it's kind of an interesting way in which I guess the libertarian point of view is that all politicians, you know, disappoint their followers just in ways that we sometimes can't predict or imagine.
Well, rather than getting into whether or not he has done criminal wrongdoing in Russia, which is a fairly complex thing with Russia and collusion and that kind of thing, can he pardon himself? Is that something that he has the legal ability to do, and would it stand up? Brian, what do you think?
I do not have the slightest idea about the legalities of the president's pardon power, I'm afraid. I'm sure I'm the only person in America who isn't an expert in that, and I'm ashamed about it, but I should not speak to that issue. I want to speak a little bit to what Nick said and sort of the general question about how libertarians are viewing this story. I had one of my rare long in-person conversations with, a normal human being, the other weekend at an event. And when she learned I was a libertarian, she expressed surprise that more libertarians weren't really super angry about, tracking down every possible Russian connection to Trump and hanging him for it. And what I explained to her, and she genuinely had never heard this perspective, but and this is my view on it, that a lot of libertarians, for what I hope are good and understandable reasons, would rather have international relations between two nuclear superpowers be a little more, mellow and less hostile, and that so we were not inherently angry at the thought that the U.S. and Russia might be getting along, or that the U.S. president might, for whatever reason, pleasant or sinister, have some tendency to not want to make trouble with Russia, and that we actually thought that that was a greater good, than tracking down whether any of Trump's people colluded. And I'm not really even sure where in the criminal code collusion falls. I'm sure people are more expert than me, but that there are, in fact, good reasons to not think that whether the president, is kindly inclined toward Russia for whatever reason is like a horrible thing that we need to stamp out.
Yeah, that was, I thought, one of the salient points that he made in the third debate, was that when Russia was brought up, he'd say, I think, if Russia and America got along, wouldn't be so bad. I agree with that. I'd prefer that we get along with another nuclear power. Do you think that if we do pass sanctions, Brian, that it'll have a negative effect? Do you think that that's likely to further chill our relationship with Russia?
That seems obvious on its face. And, as libertarians have argued in other contexts, it's fairly sensible to view sanctions as an act of war. It's almost like blockading, without, actually circling them with ships. So, yeah, it strikes me as a very bad idea.
Going back to the pardon, whether or not Trump pardons himself, whether or not he pardons his family, my understanding of the pardon, and I've read different reviews or different assessments of it from Politico and Washington Post and a few other things, it seems that whether or not he could do it, it probably wouldn't be challenged until after his presidency, since he would presumably not have the attorney general or any prosecutors actually question a pardon that he did for himself or others. I think what's very clear, though, is that whether or not he's doing something illegal, he's absolutely flouting behavioral conventions by exploring this and other things. Catherine, is that good or bad? Is it good that he's shaking up what we would normally never do, whether it's legal or not, or is that destabilizing?
I think this is like a macro that we need, along with, I didn't vote for Donald Trump, but da-da-da-da. We also need, so it looks like it's probably not illegal, but also mostly we just don't do that. Which is a frontier that Trump is constantly exploring, and sometimes I think to the good, right? I mean, the idea that we are relying on a code of gentlemanly behavior to protect our institutions or our rights is a good reminder. We shouldn't do that. We should have clear laws and rules and regulations when we are talking about we should enchain our democracy even when we are talking about protecting fundamental rights. But in this case, I think, there's been this sort of every publication has rallied up their various legal scholars to either say yay or nay on the self-pardon. I think, you know, the clear exception, right, is that, you know, impeachment is binding regardless. And also that those he pardons can testify against him in an impeachment proceeding. So and can be compelled to do that. So I think, you know, Brian is right. you know, suddenly the entire universe is an expert on presidential pardon law, just as we always are when another one of these things comes up. I am not an expert, but it strikes me that at the very least, it's good that we have a conversation about this and we should probably clarify it. The list, the to-do list of constitutional amendments to restrict presidential powers has gotten much, much longer since Trump took office. And I, for one, consider that a worthy ongoing project.
I'm just disappointed that I've spent the past 15 or 16 years getting an advanced degree in basic metallurgy so I could understand, you know, the effect of jet fuel on structural steel. And now I've got to become a constitutional scholar for another situation.
You know, it's like all those poor foreign relations people that became experts on China and then 9/11 happened. It was like, you gotta feel for it. Like, it's not easy to learn Mandarin, you know?
But it is kind of like, you know, what, you know, everything comes back into style because China is, you know, China is back in the news. And, you know, it's like, it's the skinny tie of foreign policy, you know, it'll come around again.
Nick, do you think there's much to the concerns of checks and balances being thrown out the window with Trump? Is that just extremism talking or is that an actual concern we should have?
Yeah, well, I think it's extremism talking. As Catherine pointed out, you know, he can pardon himself, but he can still be impeached and removed from office. you know, and that's solely within the hands of Congress, which limits the role of the executive. I would tend, and I have no expertise in this, but it would seem to me in a constitutional, you know, a limited constitutional order such as the U.S. has, that it would seem odd if the president could break the law with impunity and then pardon himself on a regular basis, you know, just as a matter of law. But I have no idea. But I do think, you know, and this is a kind of a tune that I've been harping on for a long time now, Trump is in, you know, he's part of the continuing slide of confidence in public institutions, not simply government institutions either, but, you know, Congress has a terrible rating. The presidency does. Even the Supreme Court is seeing confidence level going down. So does law enforcement, even the military, which still has a very high ranking. But if you look at these things over the past 30, 40, 50 years, it's been a decline. And I would argue, you know, it's been a decline for good reasons. And some of the reasons that James Buchanan would talk about, people do take politics without romance now. And you realize that a lot of these supposedly altruistic organizations or selfless organizations are pursuing their own self-interest. And, you know, you can't go through things like Vietnam, through Watergate, through the Church Commission, through Iran-Contra, through, you know, the various depredations, moral and political and otherwise, of people like Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, of the invasion of Iraq on faulty intelligence, on Barack Obama saying that he welcomed discussion about privacy only after he got caught, you know, broadening surveillance powers passed under Bush through kind of secret law. Of course, we're much less charitable to a lot of our major institutions. The one thing that politicians haven't seemed to have figured out is that it's their behavior that is causing this, and they need to repair that. And I clearly Trump doesn't care about that. And I think to the extent that he acts the way he does, some of it is very refreshing, but I do think it's corrosive of public confidence. And the flip side for that is that, you know, it's not good to live in a society where people can't trust their institutions, particularly their governmental ones. Traditionally or typically, they call for more government regulation of every aspect of our lives, even as they recognize that the government is corrupt and self-interested. And it's a vicious cycle and not a happy, it doesn't have a happy ending.
God knows I am constantly having even the minimal levels of optimism about politics that I managed to retain disproved. But I do believe that if Trump pardoned himself for any crime while sitting in office, that would trigger an impeachment hearing, even in a Republican majority Congress. If that turns out not to be true, like, you can find me somewhere on my oil platform in the middle of the sea attempting to establish a micronation or something. Brian, you're going to come with me, right?
There was a pregnant pause there.
Yeah, that was the enthusiasm gap there. Suggest you're already on a micronation somewhere, Brian, at an undisclosed location.
Yeah. He's just debating whether or not to invite me to the one he's already established.
Nick's comment that our institutions have been plummeting in terms of social trust and that this happens because of the bad behavior of government and everything else. Why hasn't that happened in older countries that are presumably dealing with, you know, thousands of years worth of despots killing people and chopping their heads off? How come America tends to be more of the standard bearer of classical liberalism?
I would say that's because we were deliberately founded, you know, on classical liberal principles. You know, we are not, you know, a nation of blood and soil. We're a nation of, you know, post-Enlightenment ideas that are very deliberately libertarian. And circle back around to Nancy McLean and James Buchanan. James Buchanan, of course, was working in that tradition. Like, yeah, we as Americans understand that constitutions are good things and that one of their purposes is to limit government's power to mess with individuals' lives. So yeah, we kind of have built into our ideological DNA the notion that government is something that does need to be kept in chains to some degree. And, you know, we're just arguing over, you know, how much slack should be in the chains, I guess. And so if we lose that sense here, which I do in my darker moments fear that we are losing it, it will be a sad, sad thing for humanity to get pretentious for a minute.
Brian, as a Velvet Underground fan, can I ask if Nancy McLean's book was called Democracy in Furs, would you have given it a rave review?
It would have given me an interpretive lens through which to read it that would have been more charitable, yes. I would have added more seams, you know, to say something that I wanted to hear.
Can I also say, though, the thesis would still be the same, right? I mean, it's just like the mink-wearing capitalists who want to restrict democracy. It could be the exact same book with that title.
You know, one of my I must have been a freshman in college, and I got into one of those you know, interminable conversations with somebody who I disagreed with, which of course I've parlayed into a career. Where a person had just come back from a class where the professor had said, you know, this is how capitalism tricks people into going along with it. They make it seem, you know, and this person obviously had read Schumpeter and to a certain degree Marx, but it was, you know, they were saying that, you know, the professor said, look, what they do is like when the workers get restive and start protesting, they give them more money and they make, you know, they make it so that they can afford cars and houses and refrigerators, and then they give them more vacation and they gull them and they satisfy all of their needs and all their desires so that they don't revolt. And, you know, and I was kind of like, wow, that is a perfect
plan,
you know, except for the fact. And, you know, and it there's a lot of that going on, which isn't to minimize all of the places that need, you know, absolute remediation. You know, we talk about this all the time at Reason in the magazine, online and videos and whatnot. But it is weird to me that and I guess it makes a certain amount of sense that as we increase standards of living and kind of the ubiquity of what even 25 years ago might have been considered luxury goods, that they're incorporated into the, you know, the basic stockpile of what everybody has and the expectations that people have, we get more and more kind of dire about how everything is going to shit and hell in a handbasket. And you see this even on campus, I think, you know, in a lot of ways when people are talking about things like microaggressions or trigger warnings, in one way it's, you know, it's an awful sign of a complete repudiation of kind of basic Enlightenment values about open discussion and dialogue and discourse. In another way, it's a sign that we have less and less to kind of confront and argue about. And, you know, people always talk about when you're trying to clean the last bit of pollution, you know, the last unit of pollution is always far more expensive and far more difficult to get rid of than the first 99. And in many ways, I think, you know, not to be Pollyannish about it, but, you know, it may be that that's one of the places where we are as a society, where a lot of the major struggles, certainly for liberation and for enfranchisement of the 20th century, have been won. And we're arguing about, in many cases, a lot of stuff that is of a much smaller order of importance or seriousness.
This is also a component in the McLean book that Brian teases out a little bit in his review, but I think has been undervalued. If you're trying to build a giant conspiracy theory around a bunch of stuff that people said or wrote in the mid-20th century, you're going to find a lot of instances where people were casually a little bit shitty and racist, because everyone was a little bit shitty and racist then. And the fact that we can now pinpoint those things for being not acceptable, the fact that we can now say, wow, that's evidence that perhaps these guys weren't as moral characters as we'd like them to be. It strikes me that it should be a sign of progress, that we should be able to say, like, well, I guess a giant, sinister, racist conspiracy isn't running America, because we mostly don't think it's okay to say that sort of thing anymore. And the fact that you could do the same exercise for nearly any political ideology, go back and find things that people said in the 50s and 60s and 70s that were a bit yuck by today's standards, again, should make us all feel pretty good about the direction our society is heading.
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic and also don't really buy the whole conspiracy theory thing. If somebody listening to this is in the Illuminati, I'd be interested in joining because I can't become a Freemason. But overall, I think we've all arrived where we are ideologically rather than being co-opted by the Koch brothers or anybody else. It's more to do with what we think. And in general, I think politically and technologically and materially, we're moving forward in a great direction. And we see this all the time in the realm of science and technology. Google Street View, for example, is now in the stratosphere. The interactive platform can go inside of the International Space Station. So if you want to go inside the International Space Station visually, you now have that ability. You can also look down at everything in America from satellites. It's amazing what's happening there. I will throw out that I read Scott Adams periodically, and a few years ago he had an article that espoused that privacy is dead, and that we need to sort of abandon the concept of it and just reconcile ourselves to the fact that everybody can see everything everyone's doing constantly and sort of embrace a positive panopticon. Catherine, are you still?
Well, that's also, if I can point out, to bring up David Brin, the science fiction writer, who is, I think, is best known for The Postman, but he also wrote a book that I believe Brian either reviewed for Reason or has written about called The Transparent Society, which it starts with that premise that privacy changes and that technology and surveillance has changed in a way that it's not a question of getting rid of it. It's more a question of living with it and reconfiguring how we go about doing things.
I was going to say, yeah, I dealt with that issue in my 2003 cover feature, which reads so quaintly now, about Sun Microsystems, co-founder John Gilmore's legal fight to not have to show an ID before he got on a plane. And, we followed up with our very famous cover story in which we, had personalized copies for every reader's name by Declan McCullough that also sort of dealt with the positive sides of this. And, I don't like agreeing with, Master Wizard Persuader Scott Adams, but if he has jumped on that bandwagon, I think he's reasonably perceptive on that issue. But he certainly wasn't first to it.
So do you think that Agatha Crumb is a better window into the world of corporate culture, Brian, in terms of cartoon strip?
than Dilbert? No
than,
doubt.
Than Dilbert, yeah.
Well, I'm curious, though, because I think that that's where we're heading. That there's a comedian, and I forget his name, but he jokes about how he thinks the CIA created Facebook, because you go on Facebook and it goes, hey, where have you been with all of your friends? Let's take pictures of it. So we seem to be voluntarily enfranchising ourselves into a system where everybody can see what we're doing all the time. Libertarians who tend to be very, very keen on civil rights include privacy as one of the things that is an issue. Where is that fight taking place? Is that something that is really more about just being able to opt out and we're all opting in? Where is that bright line, Catherine?
I do think the opt-out, opt-in distinction is important, but I think we are all opting in all the time to a world with less privacy. We have many, many, many decision points. Every time you sign into a social network or use your CVS bonus customer card, all of these are moments where you are aware on some level that you are giving up privacy. And in fact, if the infinite number of think pieces in literally every single layer of media, from like the dumbest Yahoo News report all the way to an extensive academic literature, hasn't penetrated your consciousness, you're just choosing not to know at this point. You are giving up privacy. And people do it all the time because we get amazing stuff in exchange for giving up our privacy. The notion that we can use all of these tools for free, including this, including Google Maps, which lets us cruise around the International Space Station just checking things out, and that people opt into that every single day, is not evidence of some giant, sinister corporate takeover of what should be our private, protected, secret lives. It's a technology that people want and demand and use, and in fact is amenable to criticism. If you look on Google Maps nowadays, faces are blurred because one too many dude got caught leaving his mistress's house, and
I
Google was like, "All right,
that
fine, fine,
in the
fine,
International
we'll blur out
Space
the faces."
Station, but know, where...
I am sure that there's going to be some high quality intel to be gleaned from the ISS footage soon. But yeah, the future in which we have minimal privacy is something that famous old Reason cover, that cover story, talked about. And there's a lot of upsides to it. And to pretend that it's somehow all downsides is again, to ignore the kind of progress that the world has made and that the benefits that ordinary Joes get from capitalism.
And to make the obvious libertarian point that, unfortunately, I find is only obvious in our own circles, there is a big difference between information about you being known by an entity whose only goal is to try to sell you things and it being owned by an entity whose goal is frequently, to fine you or lock you up, and never lose sight of that.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the bright lines.
And that is it. That is a noble political goal right there, to always be building walls between those two entities. And it's a tough goal, right? Like that is something that is hard, hard, hard legislative and political work, to keep the information you give to people who want to sell you an electric toothbrush from the people who want to put you in jail. But the difficulty in building that wall is not itself on its face evidence that there's nothing but downsides to the existence of, GPS and Gmail.
Two quick points on that. One is, I think, Andrew, the bright line might be something that Rand Paul and others have talked about, which is that if the government, and essentially the government at any level, but certainly the federal government, wants information for you or wants to do a search, that they need a warrant that is specific and not just a general warrant saying, the United States, in order to protect us from communism or terrorism or whatever ism you have, can just do whatever it wants and look wherever it wants. And I think that's a start. And then adjudicating that as it, as things change. The other thing I was going to say about Google Maps or Google Earth and the International Space Station, I think it was Buckminster Fuller. I think it was either Buckminster Fuller or Marshall McLuhan, and then later Stuart Brand, the guy behind the whole Earth Millennium Catalog, who talked a lot about when you could start to see the world around you as a kind of cohesive whole, most famously in a poster of the Earth seen from a spaceship, that you would start to reconfigure how you think about your identity and your the various tribes and the various groups that you agree with. And in a lot of ways, I have to say that Google Earth and Maps or whatever, the Earth view, what is been pretty striking to me is the way that you can go in. Like, I know I do this every once in a while, and sometimes I show my kids like where I grew up. They've seen it, but like we look at the houses that we've lived in. We go to foreign countries. Well, last year we traveled to Ireland to see where where their great grandparents were from, and we were able to check out the scenes before we got there in kind of real time. And it's not perfect and all of that thing, but it's really kind of striking. The more that you can see things, you tend to see them as an extension of who you are or a part of who you are or who you can be. And I think overall, Google is, a lot of people, say like if your motto is don't be evil, it means that you are obviously thinking evil thoughts all the time. And there are reasons to be worried about some of Google's activities. But, this tool is pretty great in terms of making the world a smaller place and a more interconnected place. And I think for the most part, that's always to the good.
Yeah, I'm a huge Google fan. If Google could run for Congress, I would vote for it. If Google ever develops a dating algorithm, I'll let it pick my wife tomorrow.
God, Lawrence Lessig, somewhere Lawrence Lessig just actually died. Like you just
well,
other,
well you
just
know the flip side. The flip side, though, is that Hayek, I think it might have been in the Constitution of Liberty, but he also, in some essays, he talked about how, the places where interesting stuff happens, it's not in the public sphere or it's not in public view. And it's not quite the same thing that we're talking about here, but he was a big fan of one of the reasons why cities were good is that they granted people anonymity and kind of secret space to do stuff. And I've always thought about that in the context of the American garage, where you never know what's going on in your neighbor's garage other than that it's almost always certain that their car isn't there, but it's like kids are putting together a rock band or somebody is creating the next Hewlett Packard, somebody is bodybuilding. Those kind of private spaces where you are free from public scrutiny or anything like that, historically, they can play a very bad role. When you get a bunch of Ku Klux Klanners or Nazis or something together to hatch a plan, or criminals. But it's also true that that private space is kind of the incubator of a lot of things that become really great and amazing and, are very much in the American grain. So there is a downside to, always being on display, I think.
A small downside, but I think overall this has been a fairly uplifting assessment of both technology and privacy and where we're going. And I'm delighted to close on that note. A quick and final question to you, Catherine. Given the option of vacationing 1 week on the International Space Station or 1 month in Europe, all expense paid, which would you go for?
That is not even a hard question. Obviously, you go to space, man. I mean, it's camping, basically, in space, whereas I suppose Europe is a bit more glamorous, but space! Come on! And I want to say, by the way, you gave the space station not enough credit when you said it was in the stratosphere. It's actually in the thermosphere. It's a little bit higher.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to correct me right before we signed off, Catherine. Thank you for that.
I'm here for
yep,
you.
Yep. And I'll add in anybody listening, you can see, you can't see the Great Wall of China from space. That's nonsense. It's as wide as a highway. I've talked to astronauts about that, but we'll do that on another one. You've been listening to The Reason Podcast, your pipeline to a cleaner America and a freer planet Earth. Thank you, Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mengu Ward, and Brian Doherty. I've been your moderator, Andrew Heaton, and we'll see you next time.